Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today's March 16th, 2017. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Events. Next event, Friesland in the northern part of the Netherlands on April 7th. Come to Cafe Max and join me and some of our great allies in the Netherlands for dinner in Friesland. Then I'm going to be in Southern California in May. We're going to have lunch at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, May 6th. Check out the sign-up on the website at solari.com. May 11th, I'm going to be speaking at a conference they haven't announced yet, so stay tuned for that. We'll post it as soon as we have a website and a confirmation. The Dr. Joseph Farrell Crowd Fund is going to meet to celebrate our completion or funding of Phase 1. We've ordered the organ. We expect it to be delivered by June. That's going to be in Louisville on May 13th. Joseph has already prepared his presentation. And next week, we're going to announce an exciting new $4,000 match to complete Phase 2. And we're hoping that if we can get Phase 2 funded in time to integrate the order with Phase 1, we can save at least $1,000. So we're very excited about that. And just special thanks to the donor who offered that $4,000 match. We're absolutely, as Joseph would say, we're gobsmacked. Anyway, it's very exciting. Australia, May 2018, we're doing an Australian Outback trip with Richard Dolan and Jason Bond-Smith. We have 18 places now reserved. It's leaving two available, so that is a life-changing trip. And I, having done it already, I'm still looking forward to going back. Prayer book, we still have prayers for 2017, so email, call, or send a self-addressed stamped envelope to our P.O. Box, and we'll send you one. They're free. As I always say, no matter what's going on, we can always pray. Our theme tonight is the federal bureaucracy meets controlled demolition. I talked in the annual wrap-up about the fact that the controlled demolitions and re-engineerings are going to now begin. And to a certain extent, the federal budget is a re-engineering, but for many of the agencies or bureaucracies that are going to be cut, it's a controlled demolition to them. What we saw this week was an executive order promulgated by the White House regarding a desire to re-engineer the budget, and it's a very interesting executive order to read. But then they also put out not the real budget, the full budget will come in May, but I would call it a budget blueprint. Unfortunately, there was no mention of over $11 trillion missing money. Lots of mention of $20 trillion in debt, but no mention of the $11 trillion in missing money. And since at least $11 trillion or more of that debt came, financed money that has now disappeared, I think it should be on the table. And it's unfortunate that the Trump team has kind of accepted this extraordinary imbalance. You know, the message is crime is still paying, but the game is still afoot. So, you know me, I never give up. It might help to put that in perspective. I put up a little commentary when I was, I'm perpetually frustrated that the missing money is not getting put on the table, and I keep trying to put it on the table. I put up a little commentary that compares Lockheed Martin's stock from 1980 to date compared to the S&P, and it's a frightening comparison. It's up on the Solari.com, and it's called Breakaway Civilization in a Nutshell. And while Lockheed stock is going to the moon, the S&P is flatlined in comparison. Now, why do I use Lockheed? Lockheed is by far and away the biggest contractor to the federal government, the largest defense contractor, and ran all the information and payment systems when that $11 trillion went missing. So in combination with the banks, I consider them to be one of the parties most liable for what has happened. And not surprisingly, as we've discussed before, Lockheed spun that division that controls that contract, or many of those contracts, I believe, into a separate company at the end of fiscal 2015, when $6.5 trillion went away. But take a look at that stock chart. It says a lot. One of the things that's been happening as the budget war continues is there is a steady flow of rollbacks of regulations. And for the most part, it's It's an extraordinarily good thing for the country and particularly small business. There's a lot more to be done to make sure that it really does help small business. You want to be careful for things that only give relief to big corporations. It's just going to make things worse. It needs to be across the board. There's been a lot of criticism of these rollbacks, and I think it's because it's very hard for many people to understand the difference between what sounds like a good idea versus whether or not it's a good idea to have the federal government spend our tax dollars to monitor and enforce. Oftentimes, it's a lousy idea for the federal government to enforce. It ought to be state or local government. It ought to be the market. It ought to be, there's a different way to arise at an optimization. And a lot of times, having the federal government collect tax dollars to do it is just simply not the way to get the job done. The executive order the president signed was a comprehensive plan for reorganizing the executive branch, and it requires the budget director, Mick Mulvaney, to complete a plan recommending specific spending cuts based on input from the agencies as well as outside scholars. And the budget director is thought to be a serious reformer, so it's going to be very interesting what he comes up with. Let me just, there's one thing I wanted to point out. The executive order asks Mulvaney to consider, quote, whether the costs of continuing to operate an agency, a component, or a program are justified by the public benefits it provides. This is a call for Mulvaney to initiate detailed cost-benefit analysis of spending programs. Federal law currently requires cost-benefit analysis of regulations, but there is no similar accountability for spending programs. Let me tell you what that means. That means it has to have a positive return on investment to taxpayers. Yahoo! So the idea of performance is slowly but surely getting in there. So this is a very, to me, this is a very propitious sign. And of course, OMB is the place to do this from. One of the things, that, there's more than a few sort of negative mentions on farm subsidies throughout all of this combination budget and executive order. And it makes you wonder whether $8 billion in farm subsidies are going to be on the block. Now, it's interesting. The farm subsidy program has been used to basically organize an export juggernaut of five products, basically cotton, corn, soybean, and a few others. And it's really been organized to create an export juggernaut. And if you let the farm subsidies lapse, then we're going to go back to a much more market economy, which would be, I think, terrific, but very interesting. And if you look at the blow that the Trans-Pacific Partnership cancellation delivered to that export machinery, if the farm subsidies get canceled, it's going to be, you're talking about a revolution in the world of agriculture in the United States. If you look at the as I said, the budget blueprint that's been published, this actually was Thursday today. What you see is an increase in a few departments, in the Department of Veteran Affairs, Department of Homeland Security, and the Defense Department, and then very significant cuts across the rest of the discretionary budget. Environmental Protection Agency down 31%, State Department down 29%, Agriculture Department down 20%. 1%, Labor Department down 18%, and on and on and on. Big, big cuts across the board. Department of Housing and Urban Development down 13%. So all the new cabinet members are going to be dealing with working with OMB to come to a very significant re-engineering of their operations. In addition, there are 19 small commissions, foundations, boards. Technically, they're agencies, but they're small. That have been completely slashed. They are being eliminated. And it was interesting, one of the quotes from the press conference with Mulvaney, where he said, "It's a simple message, by the way. I put myself in the shoes of the steel worker in Ohio, the coal mining family in West Virginia, the mother of two in Detroit, and I'm saying, okay, I have to go ask these folks for money, and I have to tell them where I'm going to spend it. Can I really go to those folks, look them in the eye, and say, look, I want to take money from you, and I want to give it to the corporation of public broadcasting? That is a really hard sell. In fact, some of you don't think we can defend it anymore." So it's very interesting. Instead of talking about the importance of the needs, we're starting to talk about whether or not it's the right thing to do to take tax dollars out of people's pockets who very much need that money. The two things that I would reverse, if I could reverse any of the cuts, is there is a decrease in NASA, and I would throw NASA into the basket of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Veteran Affairs. I'd like to see them get a raise. So I would increase NASA, not decrease. Then, because space is one of the things that we really look to the federal government. You know, state and local governments are not yet in the space race in a big way. Although, if you look at the size of some of our states, they're If France can have a space program, certainly California can have one. The other thing is there is a $300 million a year program to clean up the Great Lakes, and that is being the budget is proposing to cut that. That is a program that very much needs federal leadership, and the Great Lakes are national treasures, and that is one. And Marcy Kaptur, who, as you know, I support, is a big proponent of cleaning up the Great Lakes, and I think that's important. Moody's Analytics did an economic analysis of the impact of an estimate of what this budget would do and estimated that it would reduce employment in the DC metro region by 1.8% and personal income by 3.5% and lower home prices by 1.9% in the DC metro area. Now the federal workforce has approximately 1.9 million current full-time employees, and about 15%, or almost 300,000, are already eligible for retirement. So, but the federal employment group, the civil service, has not seen these kind of cuts coming for a long time, and so one of the things that's been happening is as the incomes and well-being of the average American has been dropping, the federal bureaucracy has been doing better and better. So there's sort of a non-alignment between Washington and the heartland, and part of this reflects that pushback from the heartland, for the two groups to get into alignment. And I think it would be terrific if you could get the two groups in alignment. And looking at things from the point of view of a positive return on investment to taxpayers is essential. It was one of the two key variables we used for our scenarios in the annual wrap-up. If you haven't looked at those scenarios, I strongly recommend to you. Of course, the other is the successful shift to a multipolar world. So as you watch many of the policies being rolled out, it's important to look at them on a very integrated basis, because our success in the shift to a multipolar world is critical to our success at migrating to a positive return on investment to taxpayers. And of course, within that, there's always the question of will it be privatization or piratization? Again, I would really encourage you to check out the interview, the special Salieri report I did with John Rappaport. Can America Be Great Again? We made our video. A videographer made a fabulous 20-minute little video. It's at the top of that, and we moved it up to the homepage to make sure you saw it. Here's what you need to understand about the budget. The pig is trying to move through the snake. If we leave the $11 trillion plus missing money off the table, then the reality is, this is just the beginning of the re-engineering and the cuts. And the clear message in the blueprint is the federal government is responsible for basic safety and security, and the kind of military that will back the continuation of the reserve currency. But otherwise, we envision a much smaller government and look to the state and local government to do most things for most people. And it's the classic Republican delegate downward, that we've never seen the Republicans really do. Anyway, they talk a great game, but they haven't done it. And who would have thought a New York real estate developer would be the guy to do it? It's amazing how things turn out. Money and markets. The U.S. dollar index is off a bit. Yellen bumped, as expected, this week, the Fed funds rate another 25 basis points. She's basically following the markets. Yellen said the economy is strong, but if you look at the numbers, it doesn't. I don't see it. Lending is slow at banks. Retail sales were up by a tiny, tiny, 0.1% in February. If you look at real inflation, what that says to me, sales are down because I think a lot of if you look at the real inflation, particularly on things like food or essential items, people are really getting squeezed. So I don't see the economy as being strong. I do see inflation as revving up a lot, and if I was the Fed, if I were in their shoes, I would be concerned about that. Frankly, the way they've managed the slow burn is they've basically pumped lots of money into the hands of the wealthy who don't drive up consumer spending because they're such a small group. And squeeze the middle and lower classes, and that's what's now going to happen if they're trying to keep inflation or keep the lid on inflation. Not surprisingly, the U.S. dollar index tumbled despite the rise in the interest rates. The euro is looking a lot better, particularly following the Dutch elections, where the moderates sort of came in the lead, and the Freedom Party Wilders, Freedom Party was third. So the moderates continue to win in Europe. Fixed income, if you look at the long treasury, we're now almost flat for the year, down 0.62%, 0.5%. The intermediate treasury now flat for the year. The aggregate bond now flat for the year. Junk market coming back down, so it's up 1.48%, but that's down from where it was. The debt ceiling limit passed quietly on March 15th. The focus, of course, right now is on getting the tax payments in on April 15th, and not to rock the boat. Based on that cash, we'll see how far Treasury can get before Congress has to raise the debt limits. The real problem will come in June and July before the August recess. I doubt they can go to fall, although they might be able to, you never know. I don't foresee, I think Congress will raise the debt limit when they need to. Equities, the S&P now up 6.7%, Europe up 7.5%, U.S. home builders really flying up 11%. We see an announcement that Goldman has started to buy distressed mortgage debt, so you know something's up. They're probably looking to do place-based swaps. Here it comes, and place-based REITs. Germany up 7.5%. The developed markets up 7.5%. China back up. I thought they were headed down 13.34%. For the large caps, small caps at almost 15%. Emerging markets flying up 13%. Commodities now down point negative down 4.4% for the year. Gold is holding at 6.5%. Silver at 8.54%. And oil, 14.85%. Big, huge announcement of a big deposit up in Alaska, one of the biggest, really the biggest discovery said to be in the last 30 years. And it puts the United States back up to number 10 on countries with the most reserves. So that's quite an extraordinary development and good news for Alaska. Prime Minister May has now passed the Brexit through the House of Lords and Commons and has the Queen's signature, so she is cleared to proceed to negotiate with the European Union on Brexit and has rejected a call from the Scottish government for a referendum on independence in 2008, saying, quote, "Now is not the time." That's an understatement. Wilders' Freedom Party, as I said, came in third in the Netherlands elections, and all of that has settled the European markets because now we see Austria and Netherlands both choosing more moderate and avoiding the most populist choices. So now all eyes turn to Le Pen's race in France. The first round on the presidential election will be April 23rd, with the legislative races in June. I'm going to be in Europe for the last week of March. I'll be in Belgium and then in Netherlands for the first week of April. So I'm very curious to see and hear the mood. It's interesting, when you're in the United States, the media makes it sound like Europe is falling apart. And in my opinion, Europe has a much stronger economic future than we think, especially if this process helps to lift or unleash the EU regulatory stranglehold, which was, in my opinion, literally destroying the European economy. In part, moderation reflects the fact that the establishment is now listening a bit more than they were sort of a year ago this time. And so I think the Trump election really rocked the world, and the productivity backlash is finally beginning to get through to those who are listening. But I think more and more people are listening. Interestingly enough, Germany's Merkel is going to be at the White House with Trump tomorrow, and I would love to be a fly on the wall for that one. It's very important when you're looking at what's going on in the Washington to ignore the, unfortunately, we have a group of the independent media who are grousing on the Trump administration, and it's really not useful. A lot of these folks made a lot of noise at the beginning. You know, they were very bullish on Trump, and then they tried to tell the administration what to do. Then they were ignored. Now they're saying it's failed. It's all completely ridiculous. We're not even to the 100-day mark. This is really a long-distance run, and once you have your concepts of where you want to go, you have to get in the mud, in the trenches, and it's trench warfare to get them done. And partly is when you start or you turn policies into new directions, there's a highly complex process of laws, regulations, and appropriations which have to be re-engineered. So, and it's very important if you want to be effective to respect and listen to the nuts and bolts of the process. Now, part of that's the problem of centralized systems in a complex society. And one of the things you clearly see from the budget blueprint is Trump is saying, okay, we want all this decentralized down to state and local government, because it doesn't make sense for the centralized systems to do lots of these things. So, so this is a complex process, and it's a lot of trench warfare and a lot of hard work for years. And that's why it's so important that you get a good team in. And this is a administration that still doesn't have all their team on board. You have four cabinet members, or I guess now three, Coates has been approved. So you have several cabinet members who are still not in place. We just saw big announcements of the undersecretary level at defense. They're not in place. So I just think the independent media needs to cover reality and stop using extreme talk, positive and negative, to get attention. So just beware of all that, sort of kind of not useful coverage. One of the things we're seeing that the administration is trying to do is, as I said before, provide fast regulatory relief, and they just keep dishing it out and dishing it out and dishing it out, and I think it's unbelievably helpful. What the independent media needs to do and all of us need to do is stay in the process, and we need to encourage the Titanic Turners, make sure the piggies are playing with the Titanic Turners, make it painful if they don't, and we need to help defeat the scorpions. I said on USA Watchdog the other night that it was very difficult for Trump to want to have a pedophilia scandal. If I was in Trump's shoes, I would want to play it behind the scenes and be very careful. But it can be very helpful to Trump if the rest of us are screaming and beating the drums, and doing everything we can to make life hell for the scorpions. So I cannot stress enough how important it is that we do everything we can to advantage the Titanic Turners, whether they're in the federal government, the state government, the local government, or sitting next to us at the dinner table. We all need to be Titanic Turners, and we all need to help the Titanic Turners. A couple things to watch. One of the most important questions at this administration is, will Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin be Titanic Turners, or will they let the piggies and scorpions get out of control? They have the knowledge to make sure that the piggies play with the Titanic Turners, And to beware the scorpions. If you look at who they are, their networks, if anybody can do it, they have the knowledge to do it. So it's extremely important that those two decide to be Titanic Turners, and we do everything we can to support them if they do, encourage them. Then the other guy I would really watch, because as I said, there's a very close dovetail between a successful shift to a multipolar world and getting that positive return on investment. You want to watch Tillerson. He's kept a low profile and done a very steady job. If you see how he's going about Secretary of State, I really expect Tillerson to emerge as one of the strongest Titanic Turners on the administration's team within the next year. Part of the reason I suspect is if you've ever run an exceptionally large organization, you get particularly skilled at leading from behind. You know how much you appreciated having players who knew how to lead from behind when you were leading. And if you were confident in that role, you can step into a role of, you know, working behind a number one and be very skilled at leading from behind, which I suspect Tillerson is. Tillerson is out, has been out in East Asia dealing with the North Korea policy. Expect a greater focus on East Asia and the South China Seas. One of the reasons is the convergence of per capita income and growth is coming from East Asia. Another is the dollar cannot afford for the U.S. to lose control of the sea lanes and hegemony in East Asia. And that means the U.S. needs to lead a coalition of the willing who don't want China to become the hegemon in East Asia. So that's South Korea, Japan, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, too, if they can be won back. Needless to say, the behavior of the North Koreans recently with respect to nuclear capacity can also not be tolerated. So we see Tillerson basically meeting in South Korea and Japan and steadily announcing that we need a new approach, that the last 20 years' approach has not resulted in the denuclearization of North Korea, and so we need a different approach. And it's a very intelligent way to go about it, saying we need a new approach and being there to talk with the allies about what that might be. In the meantime, Tillerson's going to have his hands full. The neocons are trying to start a war with Russia. There was quite a squabble between Rand Paul and McCain this week. McCain basically trying to extend NATO into Eastern Europe in a way that is just inviting war with Russia. And Rand Paul doing a very good job of calling him out on it. I had the blog team put the video up on the website, and I would encourage you to take a look. But, you know, you watch McCain and you think, this guy's nuts. So I tweeted out a request for an early retirement for McCain. It's really time for him to go. His control file is getting bigger than the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's what it looks like. There's more news on Modi's war on cash. The February gold imports into India are up dramatically, and it's clear that Modi is failing to kill India's love affair with gold. It's very frightening to watch the media coverage of Modi's war on cash. They're portraying it as a success story and acting as though the Indian economy is just terrific. In the meantime, if you look at the reports from the ground, the harm that's been done to small entrepreneurs, small business, family wealth, it's so ugly and horrible, you don't even know what to say. But it's the perfect example of the terrible harm that can be created by fake news. To push India into paper gold, Modi needs to kill cash and to make everyone accessible to surveillance capital surveillance capitalism. Modi needs to get everybody on digital payment system. And, you know, to do that, it helps to kill cash. It's a very, very ugly story. Another pig going through the snake is the healthcare package. The Republicans have decided of all their initiatives, they're going to give first priority to healthcare. One of the reasons is that Obamacare is really going through a meltdown. Paul Ryan has worked very hard on a package, and the president is clearly sort of supporting and cheerleading Ryan's effort. So Ryan has the lead in the House. The CBO scored Ryan's package, which is multiple pieces of legislation that have to go through multiple committees. And part of the problem is it's a market approach versus a, I would say, a much more rules-based approach. And CBO is saying many more people will lose their insurance. This is a difficult situation because it's a critical test of whether the GOP can take responsibility to govern. And you're in a situation where there are many problems throughout the wider healthcare ecosystem, which the country has not yet faced. Congress can't make them face it, although, you know, they can keep herding it in the right direction so that we get there. It's very important to the administration that this get passed. However imperfect it is, it's going to be much worse if you don't pass it and just let Obamacare continue to melt down. I think far more people will be harmed. The Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act, was over 2,000 pages long and very, very much rules-based. This is Ryan's package, is 123 pages. It's going to be up on the internet and available for weeks and reading and discussion while it's working its way through committees. So it's a much more open, transparent, manageable process. It's, again, as I said, it's improvement over what will happen if we don't pass it, but it's not perfect. So if we're going to get to near perfect, we need a revolution of individual and local responsibility and power. So I would just say we, you know, my vote is we do everything we can to support the administration in passing this. And they're going to have to tinker with it as it goes through the voting and the committee process, and that's as it should be. And then even once it gets done, there are going to be other pieces that need to be done and other tinkering that's going to happen over the next couple of years. So it's a work in progress, but it's at least we started. And I give Paul Ryan a lot of credit. It's very hard to, you know, this is really like herding cats, but at least it's a good step forward. And I think it's a very good sign that they've decided to take the hardest, one of the hardest things to do to get done first. Now, what it means is it's going to make it very hard for the Republican leadership to also do tax reform before the recess in August. So it may take till next year, but the president is very, very committed to tax reform. And now that the Secretary of the Treasury is on board, let's see where things go. Very good news. Tennessee, the push for the Constitutional Convention got shelved. Yay! So that means Utah, Colorado, and Tennessee have now all said no, it hasn't gotten through. The organizers have got everything. I think they've got 33 and they need 38. I know they need five more states. Please make sure to check with your state and stop it in your state if it's happening. The Edwin Vieira interview was very helpful to do that. Controlled demolitions everywhere. I described it in the wrap-up. I'm going to keep talking about it. We're seeing multiple institutions, public and private, run out of runway and have to start cutting liabilities or abrogating contracts or raising prices. You know, the variations of this are endless. Puerto Rico bonds are down 10% this last week on the announcements of a new fiscal plan. They were expecting to do a little bit better, but that's, imagine waking up and watching your bonds go down 10% overnight. But those are the kinds of things that are going to happen. I've had multiple contacts from clients and subscribers over the last week that they're dealing with bills that are suddenly jumping a lot. Bills that are being padded, bills that are being front-loaded in terms of time sequencing. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it because I think it's very important that you are prepared to watch your bills closely and be ready to constantly re-engineer or rebid services. So I've had several people call to tell me about amazing jumps in home insurance. And So, and in different insurance pricing, so very big and unexpected insurance bills. And that's the kind of situation where you need to pay attention and be prepared to renegotiate or rebid or reshop for something. Utility bills, paddings of different kinds, increases of different kinds, deciding to estimate and bill on estimations ahead of the meters, padding in the phone bills. It's kind of like trench warfare, monitoring your bills. One story that I heard, which was particularly chilling this week, was a person who had a Wells Fargo account, and in the Wells Fargo account they had approximately $1,200, and it was a dormant account. They were just letting the money sit, and it was the kind of account they'd look at once a year, since it was dormant and had about $1,200 in it. Starting last April, somebody using PayPal started to claw little amounts of money without their permission, but they didn't watch the account. And finally, after the person doing it or the entity doing it clawed the last amounts of money out, they got an overdrawn notice, went and looked at the account and realized that all the money had been siphoned off fraudulently. They went in to see their Wells Fargo branch and were told the money would be completely refunded, and then got a phone call this week that in fact they were only going to refund the last 60 days. Anything before that, it was their fault because they hadn't checked their account, which is an abrogation of a verbal contract that they'd received from the branch. So I had a long talk and told them what to do in terms of going in and talking to the branch and making sure they got their money back, and if the branch couldn't get it done, literally going to small claims court. But imagine it's a great deal of time and effort and work. And so, I said, look, I hate to tell you what I've been telling you for many years. You can't bank at one of the big banks. You just need to get into an ethical bank. And so, sure enough, we made sure that they got an interjection and are now opening an account at a very fine and ethical community bank. But I say it to you, you have to be careful who you do business with. It is absolutely important that you have a good, trustworthy, well-capitalized bank. And if you're banking with a bank that is, engaged in financial fraud as a business model, the chances of you running into trouble are very significant. So, the New York Fed member banks take the cake, and sometimes we think Wells Fargo, is not one of those banks. The reality is what we've seen in recent scandals in Wells Fargo is, Wells Fargo also has very similar problems. So please, get your banking relationship in with somebody who's both competent and ethical. You need an excellent bank. But the other thing is, I would say you need to budget more time every month to check your bills, to check your accounts. I would be very careful. I keep my credit frozen to protect against identity theft, and our bookkeeper is checking our accounts daily, and checking our credit card accounts, checking and we don't keep a lot of money in the accounts that we have debit cards on. So you've got to actively keep the scorpions out of your money in that day. This day, that means not only if you have accounts, even if you have accounts at a great bank or accounts with a good credit card company, they can sneak in with PayPal and phony charges and et cetera. Especially, I do a lot of traveling abroad, and so it's always amazing the speed at which that invites all sorts of credit card shenanigans from abroad. So, please be careful because trench warfare to harvest you and your money is really on, and the controlled demolitions are going to be popping through in unexpected ways. So it was very interesting. I said to one person who had multiple problems, home insurance, utility, and bank all in 1 week, I said, did you remember that I have been warning you about this? And they said, yes. I absolutely remember that you warned and that it was in the annual wrap up, and actually that helped me understand what was happening and know how to deal with it, as opposed to simply just losing my temper. Anyway, so please just understand you need to be very, very diligent. I live in a tiny house in a rural area where housing is worth very little. I have three properties, and my combined state and local property taxes are $500. And one of the reasons I chose to live here was, even if they double them, it's $1,000 a year. I can't imagine, you know, I've had people telling me, as I said last week, I had one person tell me about a property in Chicago that got the property taxes raised to $55,000 a year. Can you imagine having property taxes of $55,000 a year? But if you look at some of the unfunded pension liabilities and debt of some state governments, you know, that could happen. Anyway, Trump rally in Nashville yesterday. Everybody in Nashville sounded like they were having a good time. I would say the administration is doing a very good job of direct access, whether it's tweets. The White House website is very informative in terms of getting the, it's very easy to get the executive orders. I get an email every morning with a list, an entire list of the president's schedule for the day, who he's having lunch and dinner with, who he's having scheduled phone calls with. I mean, it's total transparency. And then they're trying to do one or two videos a week. And so it's very interesting. If I want to know something about what's going on at the White House or what the president is doing, I simply go directly to, you know, the email that I get, or the videos, or the website, or the president's Twitter feed, or the vice president's Twitter feed, or Kellyanne Conway's Twitter feed. So it's quite remarkable. And, so I think they're doing a good job of direct access. I would point out that the vice president swore in Senator Dan Coats as the next director of national intelligence, and Catherine let out a huge sigh of relief as a result of that, because I've been very nervous about the idea that somebody other than someone like Senator Coats, or someone with deep government experience, would lead an intelligence review, including Steven Feinberg, who's a venture capitalist from New York, who runs the company that owns Steincor. So having Coats in place is good news. We don't, the last thing we need is mercenaries running the review of the intelligence agencies. Okay, so the other thing that happened this week was Rachel Maddow thought she was going to do a big scoop on Trump's tax return. She had the 2005 return. It turned out Trump paid 25% on his earnings in 2005. Somebody put out a little tweet that pointed out that Bernie Sanders in 2014 had paid 13.5%. The Obamas had paid 19.5%, Warren Buffett in 2015 paid 16%, and Mitt Romney, I don't know what year it was, paid 14.1%. So Donald Trump's 25% for 2005 looks good. What I would say is that's selective. It's only 1 year of taxes. There are many years of taxes, and given how much financial difficulties he had in the 90s, I'm sure he had big tax loss carry forwards for some of those years. There's an echo chamber squabble going back and forth about whether Trump and his team were listened to during the campaign. I would give it a 99.999% chance that multiple domestic, foreign, and private intelligence agencies were listening and or sharing source material. I think the Trump team would be shocked if they knew the truth of how many people were listening to them during that period. But all of America is starting to, it's starting to dawn on America what's really going on with the digital systems. I took the interview I did with John Rappaport on Vaxxed and Other Great Stories of Suppression, and a wonderful ally, Ben Lazzardi, turned it into a story for the Health Freedom News, and we put it up on the website. You can access it there. It's a great one to share with friends and family, because it highlights all the different heroes of people who've done extraordinary things. You know, to a certain extent, the stories of suppression are stories of how suppression doesn't work, and some of the great heroes who've made sure that it doesn't. Our hero this week is Arne Gundersen, who is a is an engineer who's been following Fukushima, and he continues to sound the alarm on Fukushima and its impact on the oceans. It's hard to know the truth. I don't know what the truth is on Fukushima, and I haven't done a Soleri report because there's so many conflicting reports. But I think it is very dangerous what is happening in Fukushima, and I just keep saying prayers that the truth will be revealed, as will pathways to deal effectively with the radiation and nuclear materials. I know a lot of people who, someone told me the other day that Jacques Cousteau says he won't eat seafood from the Pacific. So I continue to be very concerned about the environmental risks to our health of what's happening. And if I were you, I would just keep an eye on that. And let's go to the movies, a wonderful documentary on one of my favorite Southern heroes, Samuel Mockabee, who was the co-founder, his nickname was Sambo. He was an architect who co-founded the Auburn University Rural Studio. The architecture work that the Rural Studio does is something I just absolutely love. And I don't know how to explain it to you. I have all the books, I think, that have ever been printed or made on the Rural Studio and their work, but I just absolutely love what they do. It's inventive, creative architecture using local materials at low cost to do all sorts of things that really fit into it's very much like a feng shui thing. They really fit into the physical space and environment in a very lovely way, but they're so creative and inventive and inspiring. So if you don't know anything about the Auburn University Rural Studio, definitely check them out. But it's a lovely documentary about a remarkable man, Sambo Mockabee. And if you want to be inspired by a hero, there he is. Okay, our interview is with, believe it or not, the first Soleri report I ever did in 2008 was with Franklin Sanders. So Franklin Sanders has been with us all the way. We had a great discussion over at Top of the World Farm about the markets. Franklin continues to be enthusiastic about a return to the bull. I've been very concerned. I've always believed we would reassert the bull. I was just very concerned about Mr. Global's ability to suppress markets and control markets and suppress price, which continues to be the case because there is a real war to get Asia out of gold and into paper gold or into digital systems. And so I truly hope it fails. But I've been very happy to see the extent to which gold is holding the 1100 and 1200 line. And so I think the chances of a smash down to 700 on a strong dollar or less. The Trump team is really committed to not permitting the dollar to run up to 106 or 110. And if the euro doesn't come apart and things are looking a little bit better for the euro, I think the chances of the 700 scenario are much reduced than they were a year ago. Now, it could still happen, but it's clear that the bull market is strong. And as I discussed with Franklin, I was up at PDAC, and one of the things you really see when you look at what's happening with exploration and mining is the ability of the industry to dig more out of the earth augurs well for support for bullion prices. It's just important to remember that the prices on gold and silver can be extremely volatile depending on the politics and what's happening in the economy. So as long as you're prepared for extreme volatility, I think there is a strengthening in the support for gold and silver, and Franklin and I talk about it. Again, thanks for some great links. We have a lot of questions in Ask Catherine, so here goes. Dear Catherine, I just finished your latest financial update and understand that there may be many answers to my questions below coming in the next few weeks. It certainly is a tumultuous time. I'm very thankful to have found your website It really does feel you were the teacher I've been seeking. Many, many thanks. Well, thank you. Dear Catherine, I recently read this article on Zero Hedge. I love this title. Are we witnessing the weirdest moment in economic history? Actually, we're witnessing the weirdest moment probably, but it's about to get a lot more weird. Artificial intelligence does that. Then they start up again. To summarize, it seems to me that many of these events stacked so closely together are not coincidental in their timing, as I've noticed in articles such as The Economic Endgame Explained. Globalists have been openly planning for decades to set in motion a vast financial overhaul and launch of a single global currency, the seeds being planted starting in 2018. If this is still their timeline, then it would follow that they would need a series of fiscal earthquakes designed to shake up the old world order to make way for the new world order. I recall the 1988 cover of The Economist on 1/09/88, which predicted a global currency for 2018. If this is the case and our personal finances are mainly in U.S. dollars, would you recommend keeping them in this currency, or should we be looking at other options? If that is the case, what should we be considering? That's a tricky question. I think if you are in financial assets which are denominated in the U.S. dollar, but whose value depends on their earnings ability, it's not something to worry about. What you need to worry about is fixed income instruments denominated in the dollar, or such as bonds or bank deposits or cash that you're holding. And of course, one way to deal with that is with precious metals. I'm a great believer in balance, and I don't foresee a change out of the dollar as reserve currency during 2017. And so right now, I'm not concerned. There's no doubt that more and more money is trying to shift out of fixed income and into equities. And this is one of the reasons, not wanting to bet the ranch on, you know, any financial asset denominated in a fiat currency when fiat currencies are being debased. So, and interest rates are rising. So I would say, clearly I'm moving slowly but surely, I'm getting ready to be a much higher percentage of equity allocations. And one reason is so that you don't have to worry about the currency. So I would say, look at the underlying assets, and you need underlying assets which will inflate as the currency debases. Dear Catherine, would you please advise your opinion if Bitcoin is a credible money option? Thank you. Bitcoin is a fiat currency. I had an interesting discussion with Franklin on this topic. And it's managed through exchanges, any one of which can and will be or may be wiped out. We've seen several exchanges wiped out and people lose all their Bitcoin holdings. So it's an infrastructure which is insecure. It's a fiat currency with nothing behind it, not even a sovereign government, and certainly not deposit insurance of any kind. So I would say it's not a credible money option. If you can use it for payments that you plan on making regularly, then it is useful for a payment option. I just wouldn't put any money into it that I couldn't afford to lose. The other reason that I'm not interested in doing anything in Bitcoin is, from my point of view, you're helping Mr. Global prototype digital currency, surveillance capital, and the end of cash, which is, to me, the end of freedom. So one of the reasons I love gold and silver coins is you can put the coin in your pocket and walk away. And that is freedom. That's the kind of true financial liquidity we need. So the last thing I want to do is help Mr. Global prototype, you know, his digital currency. I put up several weeks ago Aaron Rousseau's interview with Alex Jones, and you can find it on the website if you just click back over the last two or three weeks. Where he talks about how one of the Rockefellers told them that they wanted digital money combined with putting chips in human beings. And I assure you, I absolutely believe that that was a real conversation. And in fact, that's what their intention is. So I have no interest in helping build a digital financial system, which is part and parcel of turning me and you into a slave. So no interest. Bitcoin doesn't excite me whatsoever. So, do I consider it a credible money option? No. Not unless you want to be a slave. Dear Catherine, would you say, at least in part, this woman's march is to get. This is in reference to the big women's march in New York that was first page Wall Street Journal. Dear Catherine, would you say, at least in part, this woman's march is to get women in the workforce globally to harvest and/or profit from the yet untapped women resources worldwide, as you have said? I'm not sure what inspired that particular march, but I do know that one of the leadership's goals for the Women's Lib movement was to get women working so that you could monetize their work and generate tax revenues off of it. Before that, women were doing a huge amount of work, but you couldn't tax it because it wasn't monetized. And of course, they wanted to get greater and earlier control of children. In fact, that interview with Aaron Rousseau talks about that as well. The writer continues and says, "I'm not sure what rights women, especially in New York, don't have. It's really interesting if you travel in certain parts of the world where women's rights are really constrained. You know, it is hard to imagine that anybody in New York would have a complaint. So clearly we have gotten far beyond the, constraining women, certainly in New York. I would much prefer to see women march to protect children and to bring attention to pedophilia, because if we're going to blow up the worst parts of the governance system and get to something healthy, we need to have a major pedophilia scandal. And what's been going on is unacceptable. It's global, and it's interesting. I did an interview on USA Watchdog that published last weekend, and I talked a fair amount about the pedophilia and described the fact that if I was Trump, I wouldn't want to have a pedophilia scandal, or I'd want to handle it quietly. And I explained why. And I got an enormous amount of criticism in the comments and from various people who thought I was saying that that is what I would recommend. No, I think everyone outside of the Trump administration ought to just blow this up and do everything they can to make sure that we get tremendous transparency and accountability around this issue, because it is the basis of moving to a very inhuman society. And if we let it continue, that's where we're going. So I would love to see the women come together, and instead of talking about more rights for women, talk about how children can simply enjoy what is supposed to be the law to protect their basic fundamental safety. Then they continued, "The Wall Street Journal could have done numerous other helpful articles on their front page, such as the excellent one on Solari about the Exchange Stabilization Fund." Yes, that was terrific discussion with Rob Kirby. You're right, because if we could get transparency around the Exchange Stabilization Fund, then a lot of people in America could understand how inequality gets engineered. Okay, next question. "Hi, I listened to your last report, and you are underestimating the amount of money they have available by a few times. Think 200 trillion or more. We do not need to be taxed, only use the same platforms they use. There is a bank screen where every single digital dime they have for their illegal actions is recorded. Those who control the gold have the ability to stop this. They are being lied to. This is a planetary scam." That's perfectly possible. I don't know that it's true, but it's certainly very possible that the money is 200 trillion or more. This started a long time ago, and if you look at how much has been operating at high margin without paying taxes, the power of compound interest can take you to some remarkable places. And again, I would encourage you go look at that little commentary I put up with the Lockheed stock chart, "Breakaway Civilization in a Nutshell." Okay, next question. "Dear Catherine, first let me thank you for all the work you've done. I am a recently retired U.S. Army infantry officer with extensive background in strategic intelligence, operational design, and information operations. Read, quote, influence operations, both covert and overt." Oh, you're somebody I'd love to talk to. "With many years of training and experience around the world, ranging from a bunker in eastern Afghanistan to the OEB, from the DIA to the desert of the National Training Center, I thought I understood the way things work." Yeah, not so much. "Discovering your work as well as the work of your excellent guests has been a revelation. There have been many aha moments when I've binge listened over the last few months, Moments when anomalies and inconsistencies that bothered me over my career suddenly make sense. I know that feeling. With that in mind, may I impose and ask a couple of questions. First, I confess to being not at sea precisely, but a little adrift when it comes to following serious money. I understand economics at a good liberal arts education level. I've read a lot of the secondary literature and some of the primary authors, including the alternative views, Griffin et al. But when it comes to the discussions of high finance, it seems to me that I know enough to know I don't know nearly enough. I don't like not having a solid understanding of an aspect of my operational environment, something so affecting of my family and its future. Are there books you would recommend to give laymen a functional understanding beyond the Dave Ramsey's or Susie Orman's of this world? Half the effort, I think, is to learn the words. Every time you see a word about the economy or about finance or about investment, I would look that word up. And Wikipedia is fine for this purpose, or, you know, just a good dictionary. And it really comes down to mastering about 200 to 400 terms from accounting, from finance, and from macro and microeconomic. So part of it is just learning the words. As you learn the words, you're going to start, you probably want to do an organizational chart of sort of the different governance structures and management structures within the financial system, so that you get a who's who of the players. So I would, you know, and it's pretty easy. If you just write down all the words every time you hear a word, you know, I used to keep little composition notebooks and I'd write down the terms and then I'd look them up, and ultimately that scaled up into organizational charts. Let me walk you through some of my favorite investing books, which I think will help. I like Dave Ramsey because I like his focus on the budget and staying out of debt. I think it's very important to do a time budget. And in fact, if you have a family and kids, it's important to have a learning plan for family and kids. You need to take leadership of that. And that includes learning how to do as much for health for yourself and doing it by natural means. You all need to become your own doctors. And that is incredibly important for being economically successful in this environment, is having excellent health, because you know how to do it yourself and you know how to navigate the systems. I would certainly work through the archive on the Saleri Report. There's a little piece I did for my pastor who was teaching an economics course to his high school students and wanted a curriculum, and it's called Economics 101. I would do a search, and it was really about, I used a much more local focus to learn how to understand the economy, but one of the ways to understand the economy, of course, is to understand one business or one community and then being able to scale up through all the different layers to the global economy and back down. To a certain extent, every community is just a molecule, and then the global financial system is the body. But, you know, you can understand the body by understanding a molecule and how it scales up. Other investing books, I'm a great believer in reading Benjamin Graham's classic, The Intelligent Investor. My favorite current author is James Montier, Behavioral Investing and Value Investing. I'd read all of Montier's books. Family Wealth by James Hughes is very useful for your purpose. And then I would, frankly, work your way through the bookstore at the American Institute for Economic Research. Their investing book, I don't, there's a lot in it that I would caveat or not agree with. But I think if you read Montier in combination with everything at the American Institute for Economic Research, I think you'll get a great grounding. And then, of course, you want to discover Austrian economics. So, and I would just, you could literally just go to Wikipedia and read their entry in Austrian economics. Anyway, so that's a few ideas to get you going. And, but again, it all centers around understanding the terminology. And if you can take the time to learn each word and really understand what it means, pretty soon I think you'll find yourself being much more comfortable with the material. Try all those things. And each year in the wrap-up, and I would go back and look at the best books. We do a best book selection in every annual wrap-up. We also have in every annual wrap-up a list of all the movies we've done in Let's Go to the Movies, and there are a lot of different movies that can help you understand the economy. I always tell everybody, if you want to understand the American economy as of 1979, sit down and watch Godfather 1, Godfather 2, and Godfather 3 all together and realize, you know, that's it. That's how the economy works. Dear Catherine, I have the following question. If it is silly or too long to read, there's no need to address it. I've recently been puzzling over a question the few weeks regarding the war on women, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on cancer, the war on Ireland, the Cold War. It seems the use of the word war is a cover to actually promote poverty, drugs, terror, the division of women, etc. Therefore, the phrase war on cash doesn't make sense to me from this perspective, the promotion of the use of cash. So on one hand, we're supposed to be afraid that someone is coming for our cash. What's the other hand doing? I haven't gone back and looked, but my impression was that it wasn't the people targeting cash who were coming up with the expression the war on cash. I thought that was the pushback. So I would have to take a look. But I think generally what I would do is if a bill, I would take the name of a bill in Washington and invert the name to the opposite. And more often than not, that was the name of the bill. So one of the exceptions was I always said that the Patriot Act was the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act. But I don't think, although I do think war on poverty, war on drugs, all these words connote something that encourage more poverty, encourage more drugs. You're right, it's an inverse. I don't think I think the war on cash is the grassroots pushback, but I'd have to take a look. It's an interesting question. Then side note, my question is prompted by two additional items. Dr. Farrell has expressed skepticism in some podcasts regarding the war on cash because some sectors rely on cash to carry out business. Then Tracking Mr. Global by Thomas Hupp. He writes that Facebook is heavily focused on becoming a financial service provider for the 70 million Facebook users between 21 and 34. Financial research firms conducted analysis to gather information on them. What they discovered is they have abused the millennials so badly with student loan debt that they are very averse to debt and don't like credit cards either. Undeterred, financial services companies like Wealthfront and Betterment earn a very competitive battle to get early and mid-20 adults to use alternative financial services. Bold emphasis is mine. What are millennials using? Just phones and debits, or is cash also part of their trend? That's an excellent question. I'm not sure. I do know that they seem intelligently skeptical of the system and the financial system. But I really don't know. They seem very phone and debit dependent, so, and very sort of comfortable with digital systems, so I don't know where they come out on cash. But I think that's an excellent question. I'm going to see if I can learn more. New question. This is not a question, but sharing an article. Sadly, what is happening to education, written by a rancher I respect, a gentleman completing his doctorate at Kansas State University. And I put it up. It's libertylawsite.org. I was looking for a transcript of the story of karma about the woman who murdered a man's wife and married him, and the bird stopped singing. How do I find it? If you do a search for karma means you don't get away with anything, we're hoping on the new website that the search function will work much better. But if you're having trouble finding one on the current site, just do go to a general search engine and do karma means you don't get away with anything or whatever the name of what you're looking for, and then put a plus sign and then put solari.com and you usually pull it up that way. March 23rd, next week, Unpacking Your Financial Ecosystem. I've gotten numerous requests from subscribers for materials to help you understand the financial ecosystem around you. So this coming week on the Solari Report, we're going to do a live webinar for subscribers so that you can have the opportunity to ask questions and listen to answers in a live format. We can have a interactive dialogue as a group. So I'm going to introduce you to some initial basic steps to collect and make sense of the available data in your community, your municipality, your county. As you know, once upon a time, I developed a software tool called Community Wizard to do this. Among other things, I started to use Community Wizard to map out the high foreclosure patterns in neighborhoods experiencing significant narcotics trafficking and financial fraud, including predatory lending. The U.S. government seized Community Wizard. It took me 6 years to get it back from court control. It was a very expensive $6 million food fight. When I did get Community Wizard back, the most valuable pieces had been permanently stolen. My good friend Rob Kirby insists in a new article that we should insist that the CIA simply publish their evolved version of Community Wizard for citizens' use. I'm certainly prepared to contribute the tool I started, and the U.S. citizens have paid for the rest. So, and I suspect that there are more than a few large banks and corporations that have access to it or some version of it. So we could also encourage the CIA contractors to send it over to WikiLeaks so WikiLeaks could publish it. That's a great idea. In the meantime, however, there's a lot you can do to improve your intelligence about how the money works around you, what it means to you, and how to use that information to find opportunities to improve your personal well-being and reduce your risk. As I've said many times, and you heard me say again tonight, we all need to be Titanic tourists now, and there's no better map for navigating the high seas of change than maps of your financial ecosystem. So join us on March 23rd for the live webinar, Unpacking Your Financial Ecosystem. Then on March 30th, Cardiac Arrest with Howard Root. It's the story of a marvelous company founder and CEO of a company, medical device company named Vascular Solutions, who was prosecuted by the U.S. government. He took him on and won. It's a wonderful description of what I believe is one of the things that is happening at the federal level that is destroying the economy. I mean, we literally have the U.S. government making an economy illegal, and it's a marvelous story of a company CEO taking on that bureaucracy and stopping them dead in their tracks. Very inspiring book. The book is named Cardiac Arrest, and so Howard joins us on March 30th. April 6th is the first quarter wrap-up. Our theme is Clash of Civilizations. Can a new administration maintain a prosperous economy without debt, crime, and war? We're talking about the real clash of civilizations, the one between the lawful and the lawless. So we're going to get into the multiple personality of what the new administration is going to deal with or is dealing with, and we'll cover the first 70 days. Then Joseph Farrell will join us for the Clash of Civilizations and News Trends and Stories on April 13th. And then we'll do the equity overview part on April 20th and combine that with Rambus Chartology. And a special treat, the Exchange Stabilization Fund interview was so successful. Rob Kirby's going to come back and join us to talk about interest rate swaps, which is one of the most critical parts of the ESF operations, we believe, and has been critical to bringing down interest rates. So we'll be talking about very heavy financial topic, derivatives. Anyway, so quite a lineup. The webinar, March 23rd, Cardiac Arrest with Howard Root. Then we go into the first quarter wrap-up, Clash of Civilizations, and then Rob Kirby with interest rate swaps. So very, very exciting lineup over the next 6 weeks. And so until next week with our Unpacking Your Financial Ecosystem, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.